Ari Rosenbaum here with another fun-filled episode of that 401k podcast. This week's topic, we're going to talk about bad business choices to avoid as a 401k plan provider. Great topic for me. I like talking about problems that I see in businesses that I've seen over the years, either as an employee, either as volunteer for organizations and whatnot. So it's going to be a fun topic for me. I don't know about you, but it's going to be a fun topic for me. Anyway, let's talk about, obviously, this part of the show. We'll talk about the 401k events that I have planned, all virtual these days. We will have on October 23rd, that's a Friday, we will have that 401k virtual conference number 7. Then on Friday, November 20th, we will have that 401k virtual conference number 8. Of course, in January 21 and 22nd of 2021, we will have that 401k National Virtual Conference. Day one guest, Walt Frazier. Day two guest, my buddy, Doc Gooden. A lot of plan providers signing up sponsors. We just booked Sherry Fitz is going to give a good presentation on marketing. It should be a lot of fun. Obviously, some interesting different speakers than you would see at some other events. And we hope that you could attend. The early bird special is $20.21. You want autographs, you pay $100 more. You want a t-shirt, kick in another $20. These early bird specials obviously are going to end around Thanksgiving. So please sign up. Great events, everything you get with a live event except for food. Can't do Uber Eats orders for, 100 people. That would be a problem. And then talking about virtual events, that 401k virtual bunch, which is, again, a 45-minute live meeting on Zoom where I get to talk to an industry leader and some people off the beaten path that you probably don't know who's an industry leader, and have a great discussion where we have segues, where we talk about, their career. Then sometimes we'll talk about, stuff that has nothing to do with the retirement plan business. Chad Azara had a great comment. We had some great talk about Cleveland sports, as well as Ric Flair. So every event, every of these virtual bunches are a lot of fun. So on Thursday, October the 8th at 4 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to talk to Bill Shorys, who is the National Sales Director, DCIO for Invesco, longtime friend in the business. He is one of the great speakers in the 401k plan business that I find because he connects to the audience. We'll probably talk about that, as well as our relationship and his involvement in some of my events in the past. On October 22nd at 4 p.m. Eastern, we're going to talk to Teresa Conti, who is the president of SunWest Pensions. I believe they're based in Arizona or somewhere out west off the top of my head. Teresa's been a sponsor of some of my events, and I think it's really great to talk to TPAs and some of the horror stories they've had with, client takeovers, and obviously, the competition in the retirement plan business, how it's very, very difficult to stand out, and I'm sure she'll be a great guest, as they all are. Very entertaining discussions. You can listen to it live, throw in some questions, and of course the beauty of YouTube is I have my own YouTube channel, and you can watch it on YouTube at your leisure. Unfortunately, when it comes to monetization, I think I'm about 3,985 subscribers away from 4,000 in order to monetize my channel, but it is what it is. So anyway, let's talk about bad business choices to avoid as a 401k plan provider. And, I don't know if if you read my stuff, and I would assume that you have, if you actually listen to this podcast, why else would you be listening to this podcast? I'm a big fan of business history, especially when it comes to brilliant, business moves, as well as really some pretty, really awful ones. And, you know, I always like joking about some of the mistakes in businesses where I was right. You know, when it comes to business decisions, my track record, you know, and assuming what's going to be good and what's going to be bad, yeah, I was wrong about the Apple Store, and I was wrong about Amazon selling something other than books, DVDs, and music. Yet, I still think I have a very good track record. When I heard that Keurig was going to have a machine with Coca-Cola, I thought it was going to be a great thing. I thought it was going to kill SodaStream. And then when I saw it in the store at Target, and I realized that you're paying $300 for a machine that will only produce 8 ounces of soda at a time at a dollar a piece, I knew that that was going to be a cosmic failure. As much as I love Coke Zero, for those who know, that is my favorite soda of all time. Why would I spend a dollar for an 8 ounce Coke Zero at home when I can simply go to Stop and Shop or my local supermarket? I forget, you know, in New York it's Stop and Shop, while in Long Island it's Stop and Shop. And you can get on sale a buck for, you know, when it's on sale, a dollar for 2 liter soda, or $1.70 when it's not on sale, or $2. Heck, even if you go to the local gas station, you pay $2.50 or $3 for, you know, 2 liter bottle. It's still more cost effective than a dollar capsule for an 8 ounce soda. That being said, big fan of business history, and I've read books about business history, and, you know, I'm a big fan of Steve Jobs. I read his biography, his authorized biography. Walter Isaacson wrote that a few years back, right around the time that Steve was dying from cancer. I really love reading, you know, failures and successes, but more so the failures. Because the failures, I think you could see more a mile away than the successes, when it's so clear that they're mistakes. And one of the reasons, the major reason that I started my own practice nearly 10 and a half years ago was because I was working for people, whether it was a law firm or a TPA, who just didn't understand, didn't get it. I was vice president of a synagogue, and that was another awful experience where, you know, you're working with people who just don't get it and don't understand. And, you know, people are stubborn. People are blind. People are, you know, fallible. They make mistakes. They constantly make the same mistakes. So, you know, this, you know, topic really is, you know, really about problems and bad business choices that really plan providers really have to avoid. And number one, you know, I always think that bad decision makers never think they should step aside. So I was vice president of a synagogue in the next village over. And I was surrounded as vice president. There was a group that had more power than I did as vice president. They were called the Big Five. There were five people, mainly made up of former presidents and the current president and one of the big contributors and one of the treasurers. And the biggest problem that I had was, you know, I was surrounded by the real decision makers of the synagogue. And these were the same people that took a synagogue that had 750 members and reduced it to 250 over the years by doing nothing, by mismanaging the place, by never trying to recruit new people, whatever it was. And, you know, talking to them, you know, they never thought they did anything wrong. They never thought that they should step aside. I said, you know, if I was you, I said to one of them, I would fire myself. I would just step aside and let somebody else do that. And the problem that I see is, you know, people who are bad decision makers never think they should step aside. They don't even think that they do anything wrong. The very first company that I worked at, I was a ERISA attorney in 1998, worked for a law firm that was owned by people who owned a TPA. they owned a company called Mobius Tech. Mobius Tech was an amalgamation. It was a merger between two other TPAs called IBEX and DCP. And they eventually sold out to CBIZ, and that company, Mobius Tech, became CBIZ Retirement Services, Inc. And, you know, the problem with that organization was, you know, why did they have to sell out to CBIZ? They had to sell out to CBIZ because, I said, they were too top-heavy. There were too many highly compensated owners that they actually had to feed. And there was not enough business in the daily valuation business in the late 90s to really help support them. And one of them was a guy by the name of Dan. And Dan was the chief executive officer. The problem with Dan was he used to work banker's hours. And, you know, when you tell people that joke, banker's hours, kids today don't understand what that means, because banks tend to have 9 to 5 or 9 to 6 hours every day. But back in the day when I was a kid, the bank around the corner would shut down at 3 o'clock. It would be open from like 9 to 3. Bankers Federal Savings, which eventually got sold out to Dime Savings Bank, which got sold out to Washington Mutual, which I think Citibank had to take that over, or Chase. I don't remember. But anyway, you know, the banks would close at 3 p.m. And then if you were working, you'd have to go to Friday night. They had evening hours every Friday night. So they'd close at 3 and then they'd come back at 5 to 7. That was the only time you could bank. And God help you if that Friday was the second or third of the month. Because those were the days before. I mean, people today, the beauty of, you know, ACH, the second or third of every month is the day that people would get a Social Security check. And those were the days where the bank was just like flooded with customers because, you know, they needed to deposit their check. And, you know, we take for granted some of the technological innovations, you know, depositing checks, you know, with an app and all that stuff. But anyway, Dan was working banker's hours. And it felt like every 6 to 9 months, there'd be some sort of reorganization in the administration part of the practice. You know, they would put somebody else in charge, or, you know, they'd go from having a separate test, a separate compliance and a separate administration units. Then, you know, 9 months later, they'd combine them together. And it always reminded me of Joe Stalin's constant 5-year plans. Every 3 years, Stalin would create another new 5-year plan. And during one of these organizations, Dan told us at one of the meetings that if things didn't work out, he would fire himself. Of course, he didn't. It didn't work out. And he didn't fire himself. And, you know, the problem is executives make bad decisions, and some executives consistently make bad decisions, and either they don't see it and or they won't step aside. And of course, you know, that usually happens in closely held businesses. It tends not to happen as much in publicly traded businesses or when there's, you know, a non-owner who's making the mistakes, you know, when it's, you know, Dan still being a former owner still had a lot of weight. And no matter how awful he was, you know, it wasn't, you know, a situation where he would get tossed aside. He only got tossed aside when our book of business was sold to Bisys and he tried to get in the way and whatnot. You know, and of course, in publicly traded companies, you have board of directors, you have, you know, officers, and you have to answer shareholders. And, you know, privately held organizations, whether it's a synagogue or a business, there really isn't that, you know, really incentive for people to do their jobs. And there's no incentive for people to get called out on things. You know, when I was at that synagogue, you know, you'd have somebody who was head of the Hebrew school PTA, and the woman didn't want to work, and she didn't want anyone else to have the job. So nothing got done, but she still was the PTA president, even after her kids graduated from the Hebrew school. It's like people inflict themselves on other people, and then there are some people who enjoy inflicting themselves on other people. And that's the problem. Next, just because it's right, just because it's always been done that way doesn't make it right and doesn't mean it won't change. You know, and when I went to law school, I was always told that the way things were because they were always done that way. You know, the law school method of teaching comes back from the 1870s at Harvard Law School or whatever it may be. And there were so many different things wrong with the law school. And, you know, the biggest excuse, well, it's always been done that way. Well, what if it's always been done wrong? What does that mean? And it always reminds me, one of my favorite, guilty pleasures is the Rodney Dangerfield movie Back to School. And one of my favorite scenes in that movie is when Rodney Dangerfield, who plays Thornton Mellon, is treating his son and his son's roommate, played by Robert Downey Jr. So Robert Downey Jr., you know, he's the most famous out of the guys who... the kids who were in that movie. So it's Robert Downey Jr., Terry Farrell was in there playing the love interest. William Zabka from Karate Kid was in that. I forgot the name of the kid who played Thornton Mellon's son, Jason something or another. I think he did a Stephen King movie, and that was his career. But anyway. Of course, I always digress. But anyway, there's the scene where Thornton Mellon's buying books at the bookstore for everybody. And Thornton's son, Jason, so maybe the actor's name is not Jason, but anyway, Thornton Mellon's son wants to buy a used book. And Rodney Dangerfield's like, why are you buying a used book? Oh, well, it's already been highlighted. And Ronnie had the best comeback. Well, what if it was highlighted by a maniac? Which is a great answer, and I always love that line because it always reminds me, just because something was done doesn't mean that the person who did it knew what the hell they were doing. So, you know, when I started my own law practice 10 years ago, you know, I was very, very opinionated. I ruffled people the wrong way, which, you know, listen, it hasn't really changed that much. I always was for, you know, fee disclosure. I was always against revenue sharing. And this was a couple years before, fee disclosure did happen. And once, many years ago, I was working at another TPA shop. And I told the coworker that revenue sharing was going to be a thing of the past. And then, you know, that coworker thought I completely had, you know, lost my mind. I thought fee disclosure was going to be inevitable because, you know, when 401k plan sponsors are being targeted for, excessive costs, it only stood to reason that they want to know the true cost of their plan's administration when it was their fiduciary duty to pay reasonable plan expenses. And, you know, of course, also when you have a down market, if you always notice when there's a down stock market, that's when everybody's talking about fees because, you know, they forget, you know, it's like, you can't control the stock market, but you can control plan costs. So, you know, you can't focus on what's going on with the stock losses because it's beyond your control, but you can control plan expenses. And, you know, that was what it is. You know, and at the time in 2010, you know, we were still, you know, still suffering somewhat for, you know, the housing crisis and the bank crisis in 2008 and 2009. And, you know, people like me and people like James Holland, we were talking about, you know, the fiduciary problems of plan costs and whatnot. And there was a guy on there on LinkedIn who I don't think he's on LinkedIn anymore. He was attacking us that, you know, we were selling fear, that no plan sponsors would ever get sued over excessive fees. And, you know, the problem is that the business obviously changed. You know, court cases made it easier for plan participants to sue. You had enterprising ERISA litigators like Jerry Schlichter, who just this week got slapped with $1.5 million in sanctions, but that's a whole nother story. You know, things change, and you have to be open to change. And, you know, I was always very supportive of this industry, but I was always very honest, and I dealt with the criticism. And I forgot the guy's name. He was a industry leader. I think it was the Plan Sponsor Council of America. He was a part of a trade group that I believe got absorbed by the ARA, by the American Retirement Association. I forgot the guy's last name, whatever. Eventually it'll come back to me. And any type of criticism of the industry dealing with costs leveled by people within the industry were, you know, he went on a warpath. And I think he eventually retired. But anyway, I think the problem, you know, with that is that you need to be honest. You need to be forthcoming. And you have to be open to change. And, of course, the retirement plan business did change. You know, no industry static, even the legal business. You know, and that, of course, always talks about my famous story with the 2 years at this law firm. You know, the managing attorney, Lois, thought, you know, my ideas on getting clients and my ideas of social, you know, media and all that kind of stuff was heresy. It was, you know, akin to, you know, I always say selling fish in the back of my trunk on the side of the road. But you have to be open to change. And just because something was always done a certain way doesn't mean that it was any good. Another bad choice that plan providers make is taking advantage of their employees. You know, I always joke that the reason I started on my own the joke that I have is I've never hired employees because I was once too. And the problem with employer-employee relations is something that I learned being affiliated with a couple of union law firms was that no employer thinks that they pay their employee too little, and no employee thinks their employer pays them too much. It's a never-ending battle. It's always a fight. I just feel like that way because I worked at a certain place for TPA, and every December for a pay increase was just fighting and fighting and fighting. And that was the only time of the year where I would find out what a bad employee I was. I'd be, you know, thanked and told I was great. When it came time to getting a raise, I was told I was wasn't very good. That was their way of negotiating with me. And at that TPA shop, if you looked at the employees that were there, in one way, fashion, or another, if I told you that some of the employees that came out of that firm, besides me, you would have an all-star TPA. You have people there who went on to bigger and better things. Some people created their own TPAs. Some people became master salespeople. If I told you the list of the employees that came out of that practice, you would say, wow, that's an amazing place. But the reason these people left is because they weren't really treated very well. You know, there were two guys who left before I did. They started their own TPA firm in I believe in downtown Manhattan, and they were fantastic. They left because there was a partner over there that they couldn't deal with, and the partner over there had a problem with one of the men who could have been slotted as a future partner. And, you know, when you don't treat your employees well and you don't value them with salaries, benefits, or whatever it is, you won't keep them long term. And the problem is that, especially when it comes to being a TPA, good help is very hard to find. And, you know, losing valued and well-trained employees is bad because, you know, comparable replacements aren't easy to find. You know, and I felt that I never was valued. I always tell the running joke that the only time I ever got a bonus come Christmas time was the $300 that Harvey Berman gave to me 3 months after I started. That was it. I never got another bonus again. You know, as a retirement plan provider, you know, you're only as good as your worst employee. and you have way too many subpar employees, you're going to have a practice that is going to be constantly in trouble. Next, taking advantage of clients. And again, I just, you know, the summer, I left another synagogue. This is my third synagogue I've left. And, you know, I think that, you know, a lot of the problems reside with me, because I think that if you pay membership, you should see some sort of value at it. You know, when you're, you know, to me, it's really difficult to pay $3,000 in annual dues and feel you're like not part of the community, feel like, you know, you're a guest in your own synagogue. And, you know, they would have people at the high holiday services with tags, and they're supposed to be ushers and greet people, and they ignore you. And you're like, you know what, this isn't the way, you know, I could sit at home and not pay the $3,000 and be better off. You want to be treated like you're part of something when you're, you know, a synagogue member. And that was, you know, when I was a vice president of synagogue, that's one of my biggest gripes. I said, you know, synagogues are losing members because people don't have any value. The members don't attach any value to membership. So when people quit, they don't see the need to be a synagogue member anymore. And, you know, that's the same problem with being in the retirement plan business. You know, your clients may feel the same way, you know, if they never hear from you in one way or another. And you really can't answer your clients with kind of like I got answered by the synagogue leadership, which was a shrug. You know, I quit. And not one, you know, the synagogue president would reach out to me. The rabbi, the cantor, the only person that reached out to me was the woman who was like the office manager or the executive director of the synagogue. And she's like, oh, I'm sorry you're leaving. And that was it. It was kind of like a shrug. And you can't really deal with clients and their issues and just say, oh, oops, sorry. You know, or just have zero care to their issues. You know, the problem is the nature of people is that they don't want to feel ignored or that their needs aren't being met. You know, when dealing with a situation in business, I try to see things from the other side. It's a form of game theory, but you gain a little empathy, a lot of insight, and the ability to temporary response that won't be understood. And communication with clients is key, because when you talk to them, they don't feel ignored. They feel like you actually care about them, and you might not, but you're listening. Many years ago, I was with Lois, the managing attorney of my firm, talking to a client, and, you know, they had a defined benefit plan, a 401k plan, whatever it was, and the guy who was the general counsel was somebody that she went to law school with, and I actually was a law firm associated with, and they were talking, you know, the general counsel was talking about his kids, and I remember the discussion. His son was in Kahaki, and there was talk he was going to go to Villanova, and I think Villanova didn't have a hockey program, whatever it was. And anyway, I had Lois took me aside later. We sat in her car. She drove a Jaguar, which, you know, I always laugh about Jaguars, because I always think that if you're going to spend money for a car, spend money on a good car, and Jaguars don't exactly have the best reputation. So, you know, I always thought that said a lot about her. Sorry to all Jaguar owners. So anyway, she says to me, you know, I was listening to him. I really couldn't care less what he had to say. Thanks, Lois. Did you really have to tell me that you're just not a nice person? But her point was, I listened. I listened intently, and that's what you need to do. But please don't tell me how you don't like your clients. I don't want to hear that. It's just not professional. Of course, a few years later, that general counsel became a partner at that firm and has since left. But, you know, communication is key. You make mistakes, apologize. You know, from experience, clients love honesty and hate it when they know that, you know, plan providers just, you know, trying to put one over on them. Next, developing a bad reputation in this industry, last but not least. You know, no matter what your parents might have told you, there is no magic chemical that exists that when you add to a swimming pool that will reveal the presence of urine in the pool. There was always that old wives' tale that if you pee in the pool, there will be a cloud that will follow you. That is not true. There's also not a chemical that, you know, shows when urine is in the pool. But anyway, if you develop a reputation in the retirement plan business, it will follow you. Unlike that chemical in the pool water. Whether you're a TPA that makes too many mistakes or you steal clients from people who refer you business, just know that people will talk about you. The thing about bad reputation is that it causes your reputation to suffer in the eyes of people you may want to do business with. You know, I was working at that firm, Lois was managing attorney. I introduced one of the partners to a RIA that I had referred business to. And I find out later that one of the partners in the firm that I introduced to that RIA said something very, very bad about me. And that RIA took that to heart and, you know, told one of the associates not to do work with me. And that relationship was fractured. And that's 10 years ago. I never did business with that RA firm. And I would never recommend that RA firm ever again because they chose to believe something that was told out of school that wasn't accurate. But, you know, that was my reputation that was being sullied. So even sometimes that, you know, whether it's true or not, you know, that could be a problem as well. So you got to understand that, you know, words spread about you, good or bad. And you want to make sure it's mostly good because it will follow you. So keep that in mind as well. So hope you enjoyed this episode of that 401k podcast. Go to that 401ksite.com to sign up for that 401k National Virtual Conference starting at $20.21. See the links on Twitter and LinkedIn for all the events as well as the emails that you get from me. And I hope to hear from you soon. Take care.